This is the MedicCast, May 12th, 2008.
Transmitters? We don't need no stinking transmitters!
This is the MedicCast, a podcast for EMS providers by EMS providers, featuring EMS news, products, tips, tricks, and commentary. So grab your gear and glove up. Here's today's show with the Podmedic, Jamie Davis.
Well, good day and welcome to the MedicCast, episode 117. I'm Jamie Davis, the Podmedic, and I'd like to welcome everybody to the show this week as we ramble on into the month of May and finish up our semesters for those of us that are in school and move on into the summertime, at least here in the Northern Hemisphere. I would like to especially welcome all of the brand new listeners to the MedicCast. If you just picking up the show for the first time, listening in here to the show, I want to welcome you and urge you to head over to MedicCast.com. You'll find links to the blog over there with all of the show notes and links for everything I talk about in this episode, as well as links to all of the other shows for the MedicCast and the MedicCast Network. And you'll find all of that over at MedicCast.com. Of course, for all of you long-term listeners, thanks for coming back and checking out the show, for all of your comments, suggestions, corrections, and everything else that you do to make this MedicCast community such a great place to visit and check in with. I specifically welcome everybody who has been contributing so much over at the MedicCast forums. If you haven't checked out the MedicCast forums, you should head over and check them out for yourself over at forums.mediccast.com. It's free to register over there and contribute, and you can contribute photos, videos, comments on different things that have been posted over in the forums, and all of that can be found over at forums.mediccast.com. I specifically want to mention a discussion started over there recently on a provider that had been out of the EMS community for a little while and had witnessed a call where his mother had to go by ambulance somewhere and how that call was handled. And he didn't think it was handled very well, and it urged him to get back into the EMS game. Really didn't really like what he was seeing. He had been an educator and really didn't like how the call was handled. And so he puts in the discussion forums a little bit about how he was going to be getting back into the EMS game, getting his certification active again, and also what the rest of us were seeing out there. Was this standard now? Were the quality of the EMS crews going downhill, or was this just an isolated incident? And I contributed a response, and I urge you to head over and check out his calls on bad EMS crews, and whether you think this is something that you're seeing more of, or whether this was just maybe an isolated incident that he, as a person who had more experience in that field, knew what he was looking for, and other people might not notice that the EMS crew was a bad crew or a bad situation. And so it's just an interesting discussion, and just one of the many discussions you'll find over at the MedicCast forums. Speaking of checking in with listeners in different ways, I'll head on into looking at this week's email. And I want to start off with a great email I got from listener Jay. Jay had checked in with us, maybe a couple months ago, and was really frustrated with the fact that he hadn't been able to get past the National Registry test without success and didn't know what he was doing wrong, wanted to know if I had any advice for him. And what I did was put him in touch with some of the review books for the National Registry paramedic test, and that my urging for him was to really go through and hit those books, take a lot of test questions. It's one of the things for any kind of national exam process, whether it's National Registry paramedic or EMTB or nursing exams, one of the things that many studies have shown is that the more test questions you put in front of your eyes, the more likely it is you're to pass that test. And that's just because there's only so many different ways you can ask these questions. And if you see you know, 1,500, 2,000 test questions as you prepare for the test, you're more than likely will have seen something very similar to what you would see on the test. And I think Jay found this to be the case as well. He wanted to announce and got back to me recently this week saying that he had passed the National Registry Test and got his examination notification back when he went to the National Registry website. So you know what, Jay? Congratulations. I'm glad that I was able to help out and that the Medicast was able to be a part of your success story in at least some small way. If you have had a great experience with the Medicast and would like to share that positive experience with your fellow listeners, I urge you to get in touch with me here at the Medicast. Send me an email at podmedic@mac.com, or better yet, call into the hot voicemail line, 941-306-3342, 941-30-MEDIC, and I'd be happy to share your comments with the other listeners, and that can help somebody else have some success as well. So it's always great to share that back, and Jay, congratulations. I also got an email in from listener Eddie, and Eddie's a frequent contributor here to the show, and I consider him a good friend of the Medicast. Well, he was getting in touch with me to let me know that some of you may have gotten an early shot of this week's newsletter subscription, and for some reason, the software, web-based software that I use to get that newsletter together, sometimes I start compiling it early as I get links together earlier in the week, and it allows me to save that up there in that format until I'm ready to have it sent out on Sunday night or Monday mornings. And for some reason, it sent the email out automatically this week. It kicked it out of the system and sent it to at least some of the people on the newsletter email list. And you may notice that some of the links are not connected yet. I wanted to apologize if you got that sent to you early. Eddie notified me that he'd gotten it, you know, predated for the 12th. And so if you got that, I'll say Friday night or Saturday, I apologize for having it sent out to you early. And I want to let you know that that's an error, and I apologize. I've already sent something off to the service that I use to make sure that they're aware of it, and we'll try to get ahead of these things in the future so that we don't clutter up your email box with multiple newsletters. There will be a regular newsletter this week, and you've probably already gotten it if you're listening to this, but I wanted to let you know that I am aware that that happens. And if something weird like that happens with the show, if you go to the site and something isn't the way it's supposed to be, you have a bad link, please let me know, because I'm human and I can make a mistake as much as the next guy, and I'd certainly like to make sure that the Medicast provides you an opportunity to get the information you need. And if there's a problem, I want to know about it, because I can certainly go back and make these things right. Listener Matt sent me in a link of the week for a future episode, and Matt, I got your email, and I will be checking out that link so that we can track these things down and make sure we make these resources available. It's a link to something over at FEMA, and I'll be taking a look at that this coming week and checking it out, and maybe I can get that up in a future episode as a link of the week, or I might actually maybe even put an article up on the website at medicast.com/blog over on the blog pages where I post articles from time to time. So you can always check over there for things that I find of interest in between different episodes. And Matt, thanks for that link. I can't wait to check it out in more detail. Don't forget, if you have a link or something you'd like to share with the other listeners, you can get in touch with me here by email at podmedic@mac.com, or call me on the voicemail line, 941-306-3342, 941-30-MEDIC, and I'll get that information out to the other listeners as soon as I can. All right, time to jump into this week's look at the EMS news, and I'm going to lead off with a story that's near and dear to my heart, having to do with volunteer EMS services. And there's a great article that I found talking about the volunteer services slowly giving way to paid professional services on local ambulance calls. And, you know, first of all, I'd like to point out that just because you're a volunteer doesn't mean that you aren't professional. But I think in terms of this this article, they're talking about professional as a person who is paid for their services and not persons who are more professional than a volunteer is. In fact, I would argue that people who maintain volunteer certifications, especially at the ALS level as a volunteer, are probably much more dedicated to that professional attitude than many paid personnel who are able to get their training through their workplace and are paid to show up for training and maintain their certifications. So it's just something that is near and dear to my heart. I'm in an area that is largely served by volunteer EMS services, and slowly we're seeing some of our larger jurisdictions turning over to some at least partially paid service. And this is something that's going to happen. It's bound to happen as the people become busier and busier and can't get out to be volunteers in their communities the way that they used to, especially with the price of gas heading the way it is. But it's still something that I think is going to take time to shift over completely. Here in the U.S., we don't have anything like a National Health Service that would fund volunteer or fund an ambulance service. And so I think in rural areas that do not have the call volume to support a full-time paid staff, that volunteer services, or at least as supplemental services, are going to be out there for some time to come. Certainly in areas that are more built up, jurisdictions that have a larger population and tax bases to work from, those places have already cut over to paid professional services. But that is not necessarily going to be the case in rural areas for a long time to come, until those areas are better able to afford to provide full-time ambulance coverage for their districts. And if they are forced to go paid sooner than they would like to, I think what's likely to happen is you're going to have fewer ambulances covering a given area than they had in the past with a volunteer system. And you're likely to see that people are going to have longer transport times, longer wait times for ambulances to show up at their doorstep when they call 911. And that's just a problem that is going to happen when you switch over to services that have to balance the number of ambulance crews out there versus the dollars spent on crews and equipment to cover a given area. So read this article. It's an interesting look at changes that have occurred in the volunteer EMS system since the late 60s and early 70s. Next up, I'm looking at a story from EMS Responder that is basically forwarding the story from USA Today. This is a report on a hospital trauma center survey from major cities in the United States, cities like Washington, D.C., New York City, Los Angeles, Chicago, Houston, Denver, and Minneapolis were the seven cities that were in the survey. And 34 hospitals that had trauma center capabilities there were interviewed and surveyed for their ability to handle the surge in patients that might be seen from a terrorist incident or any kind of disaster type incident. And of course, not surprisingly, at least to anybody in the EMS or emergency medical field, they found that there was no way these hospitals were going to handle any kind of patient surge in the event of a major incident. In fact, that they had no beds available to handle a surge in patients. And this is not surprising. We have people coming in with relatively minor problems all the time, filling up hospital bed space. Patients are transferred from nursing homes and long-term care facilities in the shuffle the bed game that is played when they are low on staff. They send their patients to the emergency department. Now they don't have to have as many nurses or nurses' aides to cover, and they actually get to bill for that empty bed because they're supposed to hold the bed for the patient to come back from the hospital. And so this is a game that is played all the time. The problem, of course, is we then fill up beds in the emergency department and the hospital ICUs to the point that we can't handle surges in patient flow that might occur from a major disaster. And so I urge you to read this study. It's something that needs to be resolved, and it isn't going to be changed until the federal government changes the way that they monitor and oversee emergency departments. There are things that emergency departments have to do when a patient walks through those doors. They can't do anything until they have fully assessed that patient and managed and stabilized them, at even for relatively small things. Then they can tell them, all right, you have to go home and go see your primary care physician or go see another doctor in the morning. And until then, they have to treat them. And that means they take up a bed, even if it's for something like a sore throat, a headache, or a nosebleed. These are things that a primary care physician might be able to handle normally, but can't if this patient doesn't have a primary care physician to go to. So we'll see if this situation resolves or what this House committee comes up with as a possible solution. The next item I'm looking at in the news is a cautionary tale, and it's one that I've discussed in the past, and it has to do with how do we declare patients DOA in the field? This is another story that comes up from an incident where an ambulance was transporting a patient on an unrelated call and came upon a motor vehicle accident. They stopped briefly to assess the scene while other units were en route from dispatch, and one of the EMS providers in the initial ambulance that stopped to just provide triage care until other units could arrive looked at two patients and then found a third patient and supposedly declared that patient DOA. Later, crews arrived and looked at that patient and determined the patient was revivable and actually did revive the patient, although I'm not sure of the final outcome of that particular incident. And it's just something I want to point out to everybody. Again, when I look at stories like this, I want to make very clear, I'm not second-guessing the people in the field because, you know, I wasn't there and I don't know what happened. But I do know that this always points out to me the need for us to constantly review and think about in our own minds how we do things on a day-to-day basis and what we would do in ourselves in this situation. How do your protocols handle pronouncing a patient DOA? How do you assess a patient and know that they are presumed dead on arrival? I know in my jurisdiction in the state of Maryland, there are very clear indicators that we can use to declare somebody presumed dead on arrival. Everybody else gets resuscitation attempts. How do we do that? Well, you know, the patients, one of them is patients decapitated. If the patient is burned to the point that they are, you know, completely unrecognizable and have no pulse. I mean, there's numerous things we can do to go through, but PDOA protocols are spelled out for my jurisdiction, and I suspect they are spelled out elsewhere. So it's important for you to know exactly what your protocol says. If you're going to say a patient is indeed dead from their traumatic injuries, you better darn well go through the motions of, and not just the motions, but the whole process of assessing that patient fully. You need to listen for a full 60 seconds for a heartbeat. You need to assess if they are breathing. You need to open that airway and see if it makes any difference. You need to go through that process that you need to do. And if your protocol says you're to begin resuscitation attempts while you call medical control, then go ahead and do that. Trauma resuscitation is difficult, if not often impossible in the field, but it's something you need to do if for no other reason than to practice your resuscitation technique for those situations where it may indeed be possible to keep a patient viable and bring a patient back. And so I just want to urge everybody to make sure you're aware of how you're going to do this. Think about it so that you don't get caught in a situation where you might have your job at jeopardy or some larger portion of your livelihood from a lawsuit. And again, I'm not second guessing anything in this specific case, but it just points out another opportunity for us to plan for how we would handle such an event so that we can make sure that we don't put ourselves in a desperate situation with our careers and our livelihoods because we might have not done something completely according to protocol. Speaking of making difficult calls in the field, don't think that paramedics and EMTs are the only ones who have to make those kind of difficult calls. There's a great article over at emsresponder.com on physicians who have gotten together and released a very, grim report on dealing with who's going to get life-saving care and who isn't going to get life-saving care in the event of a disaster or a major flu pandemic? Who lives and who dies? Who gets access to the limited resources when you have thousands of patients with a problem, and who doesn't get access to those resources? A group of doctors got together and put together a list of who they think should not be treated in the event of a disaster or a major pandemic. They include the very elderly, seriously injured trauma victims, severely burned patients, and even those with severe dementia. This list is disturbing in some regards, but I think points out how ill-prepared we are to deal with the questions and issues that may come up should a major disaster or flu pandemic strike our country. When you have thousands of patients, many of whom are able to be saved, but you have limited resources, limited medications, limited ventilators in the case of a flu pandemic, patients could be maintained by ventilators long enough for their systems to recover when they go into respiratory arrest. But do we have enough ventilators to maintain them? We're not going to be able to put somebody next to them to adequately ventilate them with a bag valve mask. It's not going to be appropriate to do that, even if we had the resources to put that into place. And so this list was compiled by members of the military, members of the Department of Homeland Security, the CDC, the Department of Health and Human Services, the National Institutes of Health, and major physicians and planners from around the country. And they guidelined this blueprint for hospitals to say that everybody needs to be thinking the same way in the case of a major health disaster. And I think this is very interesting and something that we need to look at and think about seriously, because it could happen that some such list is handed to you someday in the future in the event of a major disaster or incident striking our region or our country. All right, the news is done, and it's time to move on into this week's Tip and Trick of the Week. I want to point out this week's Tip and Trick of the Week is brought to you by our good friends at Pepid.com. EMS Pepid is a great database you carry around in your pocket, whether on a PDA or in a pocket wireless phone or a BlackBerry-type device, even online. You can have access to a great EMS database with all of the tools you need to look at current drug and medication information, treatment options, current AHA guidelines for BLS and ALS care, all in an easy-to-access, easy-to-search database that'll provide you up-to-date information. Find out how you can get 10% off your annual subscription to this service over at medicast.com/pepid, P-E-P-I-D. It's a great way for you to have everything you need for your EMS practice in your back pocket. So this week's Tip and Trick of the Week, I'm going to be looking at some of the extra resources we have available to us as EMS providers or any kind of health or medical professional to look at information on drug abuse, on different problems like club drugs, on what people are using in your community as a way to get high, or drugs that are on the surge and uprise in your region. And there's a couple of different resources you can use for that. Now, I'll be talking a little bit about a specific issue later on in the show with our Med of the Week, and that'll be a special segment from Lisa Booz over at Maryland Poison Control. She's got another segment for us on dextromethorphan overdoses. But I wanted to talk a little bit about how you can find out more about things in your region specifically. First of all, I want to point out that there's a great resource over at the National Institutes of Health, and that is the National Institute on Drug Abuse, NIDA, a great resource with information for medical and health professionals, for parents, for teachers, for students and young adults, and even they have a whole section for Spanish-speaking individuals, all over at the National Institute on Drug Abuse, and that can be found at nida.nih.gov. So nida.nih.gov, and you'll find all kinds of information over there. There's a whole section for medical and health professionals that includes a message from their director, as well as a number of links for commonly abused medications, commonly abused illegal drugs, prescription drugs, different medical consequences, how the brain and the body react to addiction. Why do some people become addicted and others don't? As well as links for patient information and handouts you can give out in your community on different drugs of abuse, club drugs, alcohol, cocaine, heroin, inhalants, marijuana, ecstasy, you name it, there's something on that list that can be used and accessed in your region. And that can be found over at the National Institutes on Drug Abuse website. I urge you to head over. There's links in the show notes for this particular site. You'll find out a lot more about what you can access for your particular region. But what else do we have out there as a resource? Another great resource is the Centers for Disease Control website. The Centers for Disease Control compiles information on injuries, on things like overdoses and poisonings, on deaths, on general disease process for every region of the country. And they publish that information in numerous different newsletters that you can get by email. They will send you information on your region or about a specific type of injury or process. So if I want to look at their section on injury, violence, and safety, I can find out more about how injuries occur in my region or in the country as a whole. All kinds of great statistics that you can bring back and use for things like presentation in a local high school, on teen drunk driving, on violent deaths, on safety in the workplace, adolescent injuries, child abuse, choking, dog bites, you name it, they can cover it in this particular incident. What are the statistics for your region on accidental and intentional poisonings? All of that can be found in this particular segment of the CDC website. And that's just one section of information on this website. We're coming up on the summer season here in the U.S., and that means the 4th of July is coming. People are going to be setting off fireworks. Well, guess what? There's a whole section on fireworks statistic and a spotlight on how these injuries occur and what types of injuries can we expect to see and who is likely to be injured. So you can prepare training for your region or for your fire station or EMS service on what types of injuries they might see coming up over the 4th of July holiday in a few months. So that's just another resource for you, and that can be found over at cdc.gov, the Centers for Disease Control site. Finally, I have a link in the show notes for the list of the Centers for Disease Control links to all of those web pages, and you'll find that over at the Poison Control Central website. And also remember that you have access to a lot of information just by calling your local Poison Control Center. It's a free call, 1-800-222-1222. That's 1-800-222-1222. And you can get a hold of your local Poison Control Center if you have a question about a medication overdose or the side effects of a particular medication. They are there to assist you. It's their job, and they really want to help in the community. And you can provide them access to your organization. They can come out and do training in your organization if you'd like about specific poisonings or injuries that are common in your region. You can also check out the links in the show notes for specific regional poison control centers as well. So those are three great resources for you to look at for injuries, overdoses, poisonings, and other things like that that you can access from any computer and get information for your training center, for your own personal knowledge base, or to provide information for a community-based presentation that you might be preparing for, all at any of these three links. And you'll find links to those locations in the show notes. And that's this week's tip and trick of the week. As I said earlier, this week's Med of the Week is going to be a featured talks tidbit from Maryland Poison Control, and this is the beginning of my quick interview segment with Lisa Booz from Maryland Poison Control. You can find out more about their services over at mdpoison.com, Maryland Poison Control. And without further ado, here is Lisa's interview segment. Hi, this is Jamie Davis, the Pod Medic, and I'm back here with another episode segment of the Maryland Poison Control's Toxicology Minute, and I have Lisa Booz on the phone with me again. Hi, Lisa. How are you doing today?
Fine, thanks. How are you doing?
Really well, really well. So I'm really waiting with bated breath to find out what you have for us again this month.
Well, we're going to talk about dextromethorphan abuse and toxicity associated with it. It's something that poison centers have been seeing a huge increase in over the years. If you're not familiar with it, dextromethorphan is an over-the-counter cough suppressant that actually has been used very safely in cough medicine since the 1950s. It started out as a substitute for codeine when it was found that people were starting to abuse cough medicines with codeine. So they started putting dextromethorphan in the cough medicines instead. In the 1960s, people did start to abuse dextromethorphan, but it wasn't widespread. But since the late 1990s, we've seen a huge increase in primarily adolescents that have been abusing dextromethorphan. It produces sort of a euphoric and also hallucinogenic effects. The other reason that they like to abuse these products is because they're over-the-counter. They're very easy to get at pharmacies and supermarkets and other stores. They're very inexpensive compared to other drugs on the street or other prescription drugs that can be abused. They're easy to hide from parents, and they're perceived safe since they're available over the counter. According to the Partnership for a Drug-Free America, 1 in 10 teenagers have intentionally abused dextromethorphan products to get high. As I mentioned, poison centers have been hearing a lot of dextromethorphan abuse and toxicity. The number of cases in teens that have been reported to poison centers in the United States increased by 100% between the years of 2000 and 2003. So that's a big jump with a drug that actually has been around for a long time. Abuse isn't limited to teens, though. We also get calls about other age groups, and the number of calls in those age groups have increased as well, but not as greatly as what we've seen in the teenagers. Now, dextromethorphan is available in many forms. It comes in tablets, capsules, liquids, sprays, comes in cough drops, and most of the products typically have somewhere around 10 to 15 milligrams of dextromethorphan per dosage unit. So that would be per tablet or per capsule or per teaspoonful, for example. Some of the brand names that are abused are Robitussin DM, NyQuil, Delsim, and there are a lot of others, but by far the most commonly product that's abused is Coricidin, HBP, cough and cold. And the reason that that's abused more commonly is because it contains 30 milligrams of dextromethorphan in each little red tablet, and that's more than what's in other products. And it also is in combination with another medicine, but not some of the more toxic medicines.
So it's just to interrupt you for a second, but it's important for all of the medical personnel out there to hear this very carefully and understand that it's very important that we, if at all possible, try to get a box of the medication or find out what the brand and particular dose was so that we can report that information and get a better sense of how much was ingested.
Right, exactly. It's very important so that we do know how much was ingested of the dextromethorphan, but sometimes it's even more important because of the other ingredients. Because in the long run, if it has acetaminophen in there, or it has maybe an antihistamine or a decongestant or aspirin or something like that in that product, those other ingredients are often more toxic than the dextromethorphan. So it is very important to try to figure out which product it is. Fortunately, if they give you a slang name, sometimes you can tell which product it is based on the slang name. For example, triple C is a very, very common slang name, and that corresponds to Coricidin, cough and cold, and mainly because there are three C's printed on the tablet. CCC is another slang name for Coricidin, cough and cold. Robo or Roho is sometimes used for Robitussin DM. Red Devil sometimes for the Coricidin, cough and cold. And then there are some other sort of generic slang names like Dex or DXM and Skittles. That's another slang name that we're hearing a lot about. People, these kids are saying that they've taken Skittles or that they're skittling, and it doesn't mean the candy. It usually means one of these cough and cold products. Sometimes the products are sold on the street. Sometimes they're sold at parties like raves. Sometimes they're disguised as another drug or sold in combination with other drugs like ecstasy. But usually the kids will actually just buy the product off the shelf and use that to abuse it. Some, you know, it is over the counter, but there are some states and some legislators that are trying to put some controls on it. Now, we've seen in the past where there have been controls on Sudafed products. You know, they've been put behind the counter, so people have trouble buying it. Sudafed is used to make methamphetamine, so there's some controls on that. And they're trying to do similar things with dextromethorphan, either put it behind the counter. Some pharmacies actually keep the products actually right in front of the counter so that they can see who's buying it and how many that they're buying. But hopefully in the future, there might be some legislative controls over who can buy the products, particularly minors. There's a push to not allow minors to buy these products, only adults. Dextromethorphan is pretty safe when it's taken as directed, but abusers really do take much higher doses. So it's not uncommon for teens to take maybe 10 tablets, 20 tablets, whole packages, whole bottles of the liquids. We have this little joke at our poison center that one of the common amounts that people take will be 24, which seems like an odd amount, but that's how some of these products are packaged, you know, in packages of 24 in those little blister packs. And so they'll take a whole pack of those or two packs, which would be 48 tablets. So it does take quite a bit to get the high that they want from the dextromethorphan. Again, that is a problem because of the other ingredients that are in there too. People often don't realize that dextromethorphan is actually derived from an opioid, and it does have some activity at opioid receptors, but it's considered non-addicting. And it doesn't really produce effects like an opioid. It's much more similar to maybe a PCP type of effect or ketamine. They describe the experience as being similar to an alcohol intoxication in low doses. And sometimes there's distortions of colors and sound or hallucinations. And then in higher doses, you get pretty severe sensory distortions. And they usually describe it as an out-of-body experience. And that also is very similar to what's seen with PCP or ketamine. Most cases reported to poison centers really result in mild effects with mostly neurological effects. So they might be lethargic and hallucinating or agitated. They often have nystagmus, which are rapid eye movements. And they may have an increase in their heart rate, an increase in their blood pressure, an increase in their temperature, some nausea and vomiting. That's usually pretty common because of maybe the other ingredients that are in the products. Seizures, respiratory depression, aspiration following vomiting, requiring intubation, that's been reported, but rarely. And again, if people do die, if teens do die after taking these products, usually it's from the other ingredients and not the dextromethorphan itself. However, there are deaths that are reported as a result of trauma because the dextromethorphan alters your judgment and impairs your senses. So kids sometimes will, you know, run out in the middle of the street or misjudge how close a car is to them, and so you have some trauma patients that are that you're called to because of the as a result of the dextromethorphan use. Treatment. Basically just supportive care, activated charcoal if the ingestion has been within a few hours. The charcoal might bind the dextromethorphan and the other ingredients. Now, unfortunately, most of the time, by the time the poison center is called or EMS is called to the scene or the patient arrives at the hospital, the toxic effects have already developed. And so in a lot of cases, it's too late to give activated charcoal. But it can be given if it's early on. Sometimes their altered level of consciousness contraindicates giving charcoal because of the risk of aspiration. Now, remember I said that dextromethorphan does have some activity on opioid receptors, so it's recommended to try naloxone, you know, just like you would for your heroin overdoses.
Really?
Or your
That's interesting.
Percocet. Now, because it doesn't act as or doesn't bind as tightly to these opioid receptors and it acts a little bit differently, it may not work. You know, it doesn't. It's variable. Sometimes it works, sometimes it doesn't. If it does work, sometimes you need pretty large doses, like on the order of 1 to 2 milligrams. But we always like to try it. You know, so if they're, you know, severely toxic, if they're having some problems with some respiratory depression, or a lot of CNS depression, you certainly can try naloxone and see if that helps. And obviously call the Poison Center. Our phone number is 1-800-222-1222, and that'll connect you to the Poison Center in your area, and we'll help to assess the dextromethorphan overdose and recommend any treatment that might be appropriate for that patient.
Lisa, thank you very much. That's a lot of great information and pretty alarming when you hear about numbers increasing that rapidly on any kind of readily available substance abuse situation. It's really easy for kids to get a hold of this stuff either from their own medicine cabinet or go out and purchase it themselves. And it's something to be aware of. And thank you very much.
Oh, you're welcome.
And I want to remind you all that in your region, at least in the United States, that number is 1-800-222-1222, and that is your direct line to your local poison control center so you can get information that you need from them. And I think that's going to wrap up this week's episode of the MedicCast. I want to remind you, head over to mediccast.com/blog. In the podcast category over there, you will find links for everything I've talked about in this and every other episode in the show notes. And that's a great way for you to follow up on the information presented here. Remember, it's your resource, but you have to make sure you're operating within your own protocols or under the guidance that is specified for you by your medical director or your instructor. And that's your job. I can present you some general information, but it's your job to make sure that you apply it responsibly within the scope of your own practice. If you have any comments or suggestions you'd like to add, or even corrections if I've made a mistake somewhere along the way, please don't hesitate to get back in touch with me here at podmedic@mac.com by email, or call into the voicemail line, 941-306-3342. That's 941-30-MEDIC. Okay, time to check out of the show here, and I'm going to end, as I always do, with some great PodSafe music. It's a song I haven't played in a long time, but it's one of my favorites, kind of the podcaster's anthem, if you will. This is Jeff Smith's Not on the Radio. You can find access to that over at Jeff's website at thejeffsmith.com. There's a link in the show notes. Let Jeff know you heard his song here on the MedicCast. That's it for this week, folks. I'll be back Tuesday night with the MedicCast Live. I look forward to talking to all of you there. Until then, I'm Jamie Davis, the Pod Medic, reminding all of you, scene safety, BSI.
Somebody told me you're in San Francisco. They said you're working in a box,
yeah, a cubicle.
Somebody told me that you're not on top of the world. You're probably walking down the street with your earbuds jammed so deep in your ear,
yeah, you're going deaf.
You probably found this little MP3 for free. It's way cooler out there,
yeah, I think so.
But maybe you just like it in your cozy little world. Well, you can play this, but not on the radio. I made this just so I can let it go. Does anyone around here still have a radio? Anyone here at all? Anyone here?
us out in Wheeling, West Virginia. We could make it on our own,
and we'll do it just fine.
I can't afford your record, but it's out of sight. Well, you can play this, but not on the radio. I made this, but not for the radio. Hey, now, switch off your radio, off your radio. Does anyone